You're listening to 93.7 San Francisco Liberation Radio, your local community non-corporate radio right here in San Francisco and the Bay Area. And this is Vico here with the Vico Show. And we have on the line our guest for today, who is Paul Helfrick, Ph.D., and he is Director of Programs and Technology for New World Views. And I'm sure we can, you may be asking what that is. We'll answer that as we go. Our topic for today is going to be fairly broad-ranging, but it will center around perennial philosophy, channeling, and the Seth phenomena. Just a quick aside before we get into it. I've noticed that in the vernacular there are a number of words that have been vilified by in common usage, and a couple of them come to mind. Anarchism, for one, the word anarchy seems to be to have taken on a new definition that is opposed to the definition that was originally intended when the word was invented a little over 100 years ago. Other things come to mind. The words astrology has come to mean something completely different from what it has meant historically. Well, perhaps not completely, but definitely it has been made to be taken less seriously, I guess, as anarchism is as well. And our topic for today, which is going to center around channeling, which is another word that I think in the popular culture has been somewhat degraded and made to seem silly and not serious, not to be taken seriously as those other words. You might want to go out there yourself and look for other words like that. There are a plethora of them. Maybe I'll do a show on that one time. But we have on the line Paul Helfrick, Ph.D., and we're going to explore some of these issues. Paul, welcome to the show.
Hi, Vico. Thanks. Good to be here.
Yeah, Paul has... welcome back. He was on a few months ago. We did a show on perennial wisdom, and now we're going to expand that discussion. Where do we begin? So, Paul, why don't we start out by, why don't you let people know about New World View, what exactly that is, and maybe give out the address?
Sure. We're a small company dedicated to providing forums in which to explore the practical applications of what we call conscious creation, or the idea that you create your own life, that you form it, and that deals with relationships, health, abundance, whatever you choose to manifest in your life. And the address for our website is www.newworldview.com, and New World Views, all one word, and there's discussion forums there. We have a library full of articles, and we've done conferences and seminars that promote dialogue and the exploration of practical applications of this version of perennial wisdom that we call conscious creation.
Perhaps that's a good place to start. What exactly is conscious creation?
Well, before I dive into that, you had mentioned the term channeling earlier, and I wanted to tie a couple of ideas into our conversation this evening. When I last appeared on your show back in April, I talked in general about one of the big themes that I see facing us in the 21st century, which is the work involved in bridging science and spirit. And it's a very important area of exploration and work. And we talked about the perennial wisdom as one area representing the common elements in the area of spirit. And you mentioned the concept of channeling, and that's something that I should talk a little bit about before we get into conscious creation, because that's sort of a mechanism by which some of the information that we explore in conscious creation was generated by. And channeling is something, as you stated at the outset of the show, is an idea that is mostly misunderstood and couched in ignorance in mainstream society. And so part of what we do at New World View is to help educate and promote information about the channeling phenomenon. And I guess I'll just tell a little story. Back in 1997, I had a friend and his wife over for dinner, and my wife Joanne cooked a delicious dinner, and afterwards we retired to the living room, and I wanted to share some information without proselytizing, without evangelizing, but sharing something that I and she, Joanne, were interested in. And we put on a tape of this woman named Jane Roberts channeling a personality that she called Seth. And we only showed about 5 minutes of it, and there was sort of a silence while we were looking at it. And afterwards, there was an awkward silence before they could even formulate a question. Now, my friend, he's a musician, and he's very interested in science and so forth. But this paranormal, the area of channeling, I guess we can put in paranormal and parapsychology. He wasn't quite sure what to ask, but his wife just spit right out, "How do you know that that's not the devil coming through?" And it kind of took me aback. I mean, I had never even considered that, honestly, because I don't believe in a personified, anthropomorphized, humanized focus of energy called a devil. But once I got my focus back, I said, well, that's a good place to start. And I said, well, if you grant that this personality that's coming through this woman, that's clearly not her main personality, could be the devil, well, why couldn't it also be an archangel or an angel? And suddenly her face lit up. And I realized right there that, you know, we have this knee-jerk reaction to things that we don't know. We're taught to fear things we don't understand. And of course, the devil or archangels is not really what channeling is about. It's about a spectrum of human potential and human ability. When we look at scientific definitions and religious definitions, we don't get clear-cut answers. And like harking back to this idea of bridging science and spirit, the best of religion, theology, cosmology, and scientific endeavor, we still don't have adequate answer to define clearly what channeling is or isn't. But in terms of conventional scientific wisdom, in the book of psychiatry, where they have the official diagnoses, it would be labeled as dissociative personality disorder. The personality that comes through would be considered a hallucination or imaginative or not real. And on the other hand, when you try to find out about that phenomenon, you have a phenomenon called glossolalia, which is speaking in tongues, which is a religious frenzy that I've only observed on TV on the religion channel. And speaking in tongues, you know, that is some evidence of spirit manifesting on the person. And yet the question has to be, how do you discern whether it's a friendly spirit or a not friendly spirit, to quote Roxanne Baldwin. So the channeling phenomenon is not clearly understood, and it's something that's wide open. And perhaps I'll leave it there for the moment. We can come back to it.
Okay. So we're talking about an area that as you say, is not completely understood. But just as in scientific endeavor and many other areas in life, we continue to explore things precisely because they're not completely understood. What about May, why don't you give us a little bit of history of channeling, perhaps give the listeners a little bit of background on where this has occurred historically and where it's occurring now.
I mentioned that story of my friend in 1997, 5 years ago, and that led me to do research into the area of psychology, parapsychology, and continue in that area. I'd done some research back in the late 80s and early 90s when I was doing a science exhibit at the Science Museum, worked at on the brain. There's two authors that I want to mention for anyone who's interested in finding a more scientific framework. These are both psychologists. And the first one is Arthur Hastings, and then you can do a search on his name on the internet, and John Klimo, J-O-N-K-L-I-M-O. And basically, the research that I did in parapsychology through Charles Tart and other scientists exploring the paranormal and what are called psi phenomena, telepathy, telekinesis, and so forth, led to these two authors And it turns out, based on their research, that there's written evidence that goes back over 30 centuries. So there's a 3,000-year tradition in which what we can loosely call channeling seems to be present in every culture manifest that kept written records.
Extraordinary.
And that's why when we talk about the perennial wisdom and religion and so forth, there's a very intimate relationship between this phenomenon of channeling and religious movements. And in the Bible, we have Moses who was spoken to by a burning bush. Now, we're taught that as little kids, and I've always had this image of a burning bush. And if you look at the Ten Commandments done by Hollywood, a burning bush talks to Charlton Heston. I don't think that's really what happened. I think that's a metaphor for this state of mind that we're calling channeling that most likely occurred all those centuries ago. We look in Islam, and the Prophet Muhammad, also called the Messenger of God, was meditating in a cave, and the Archangel Michael spoke to him, or perhaps spoke through him, if he went into an altered state and another personality manifest, and so on and so forth. In the Old Testament, there are many instances of, and the Lord spoke unto so-and-so. And that actually stops in the New Testament. At some point, as those religions, Judaism and then Christianity, as it came out, the channeling, you know, it's a tricky thing because you get information that has usefulness, but it can also be misused and misunderstood and distorted. So I guess I'm raising right away here the issue of discernment, which is something when we talk about the channeling phenomenon and theology in general, interpreting scripture, interpreting a conversation, discerning the truth is a very important area. So moving then into the Middle Ages, the Renaissance happens in the late 1500s, begins to happen 1600s into the 1700s. And this phenomena of channeling occurs in what's called spiritualism in the 19th century. And into the 20th century, William James, a famous psychologist, was researching this along with others back at the turn of the century. And Madame Blavatsky, Alice Bailey, Edgar Cayce, and other names like that are in the field that were involved in some form of channeling. So the point when we talk about the channeling phenomenon, to be clear, it's not black and white. It's not you channel or you don't channel. We can look at a musician, a concert pianist, is not born playing the Rachmaninoff third piano concerto. They take time to learn that ability and refine it. An athlete is not born hitting 73 home runs in a season. That takes time to develop that ability. So it's a spectrum of human potential, of human creativity, of human ability that takes time to develop. And in the beginning, just like with an athlete or with a musician, as with any channeler, you can have a lot of junk, a lot of garbage. And in fact, I suspect that people who flirt with this ability leave it. They don't understand it. They don't have a framework except for these scientific, which say you're schizoid, or a religious one which says you're, you know, it's demonic possession, evidence of a demon or Satan. They leave it alone because they fear it and they don't get it. So only in those cases where there's this persistence, and I just think of it as an innate intention of the personality, does this skill develop and manifest and blossom? And again, just to reiterate, the discernment issue becomes very important down the road. But discernment's important in scientific research also. Discernment's important in music, discerning a good performance versus a mediocre performance, a good orchestra or band versus a mediocre one.
So we're talking about an ability that someone gradually learns that as you said, a spectrum that doesn't have any black or white, as in art, which it seems to me, I've actually heard stories of people, I don't know if the word channeling was used, but I've heard of, you know, guitar players saying they were possessed by the soul of Jimi Hendrix and they could play exactly like him for, you know, just a short period of time, or other such musicians. That seems to be a fairly common thing.
And that raises a question, can we all channel? And according to Klimo's work and my own research, I think we do. And we call it being in the zone, going with the flow. It is an altered state. And I remember playing intramural basketball in eighth grade, and the very first time, I mean, I got about six baskets in a row. I couldn't miss. And it was the weirdest feeling. And that was an altered state. I was in the zone. And this happens in professional sports when a team makes a great comeback and they get a rally or whatever, and something really clicks. So it's part of our innate psychology. Klimo calls it open channeling, which means that it's a creative, enhanced state of being, and as you mentioned, the example of someone channeling Hendrix, John Coltrane, the sax player, you know, when he would play, going to church. And it took me years to understand that, but I had the epiphany where he wasn't channeling the way someone like Jane Roberts went into an altered state and another personality with distinct facial features, emotions, gestures came through. But he sort of stepped aside where he just let go. And something else within him that is part of him that is not a rational thought process takes over. And it's just the natural, effortless, almost magical, not in the terms of ceremonial magic, but an effortlessness, almost miraculous, that defies scientific, mathematical definition takes over. So
yeah,
it's interesting.
Yeah, I think probably most athletes and musicians, you know, especially noted ones, could give stories of, very similar to that, that they're just going with the flow, that they're letting go and letting something else take over. That actually reminds me of the film Bull Durham, which is actually about that, about the Tim Robbins character learning to do that. But so this actually, this idea is out there in popular culture. And it also occurred to me when you were saying about throwing the baskets that perhaps this is beginner's luck. Perhaps people don't know enough to fail at something they don't really understand yet. I think that, like you said, perhaps this is a lot more common than is generally thought. That people, for instance, people go into altered states all the time. Watching television, you're in an altered state of consciousness. Anytime you do a creative act like writing, you're in an altered state of consciousness. And there's something else going on there. Usually people don't pay attention, perhaps, to or notice that their consciousness is altered, but it is. And that might be a good thing to pay attention to. Perhaps you could talk about that a little bit, altered state of consciousness, how common it is, and what is there any research on altered states in the scientific community?
Yes, there is, you know, 80 years of research in exceptional or paranormal parapsychology is what it's been called and is still referred to in some areas, beginning with J.B. Rhine, the experiments at Duke University with the classic telepathy or mind reading experiments where he had a set of five cards with a star, a square, a circle, three wavy lines. And according to statistical mathematics, I believe that if you get one in four, so if you do a set of 40 guesses and you get 10, that's about average chance. So if you get more than 10, it means that something might be happening. And in certain cases, they had subjects who would get over 50, 60, 70% sometimes. And that's an anomaly. That's a blip that shows some evidence that something's going on. We still cannot explain it scientifically, but we're attempting to, again, back to this bridging science and spirit work that's going on. I also wanted to mention that when we ask what is channeling, what is the channeling phenomenon, we're really asking what is the nature of human personality? What is the nature of human consciousness? Who are we? What are we? And then you get into why are we? How are we? And and questions like that. And that's a bigger story. And some of what we're going to talk about later are some of the ideas that came through this Seth phenomenon, this personality channeled by Jane Roberts, that offered information about what I just generally call God, life, the universe, and everything, which is quoting Douglas Adams, who's the author of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. But in all seriousness, we're looking at the nature of ourselves and who we are. And this channeling phenomenon is an anomaly in scientific terms. There's still not an adequate explanation for it. So that means the scientific paradigm in terms of dissociative personality disorder, schizophrenia, multiple personality, is not an adequate explanation of human psychology. And we need to remind ourselves that it's only been in the last century, give or take, starting with the work of Freud, perhaps, in the late 19th century, that psychology elevated itself to a soft science. It's not a hard science in terms of just measuring things with mathematical languages and producing quantitative results. It's a qualitative study of the human mind. And Freud had definite results and cured illnesses and psychoses and psychotic states and so on. But it wasn't a panacea. It wasn't a cure-all. His work was then carried on by Carl Jung. And now the transpersonal psychologists in that field, which is in the Bay Area, Berkeley and other places, institutes in the Bay Area primarily, and the bleeding edge of which is integral psychology, which is attempting to look at science, art, and spirit, the whole creative tapestry of human endeavor, and bring them all to bear. So merging quantitative measurements and qualitative aspects of any phenomenon.
So I guess what we're looking at here is that even science itself is a spectrum, and it's not black and white proposition.
Absolutely not. You have, on one hand, the hard sciences, biology, physics, which explain light and sound, biology, neurochemistry, brain and body function. But then you have cognitive sciences, which are softer sciences that get more into the inner subjective and qualitative aspects. But again, when enough people believe a certain way, you get a consensus view or belief system, and we take it from there. And when people can use those qualitative values to help cure people of dysfunctional relationships with themselves or with others, then that's very valuable. So we're realizing that the qualitative parts of the scientific paradigm or model that goes back to Descartes and the Age of Reason and Newton's mechanistic, you know, clockwork universe that can be broken down into parts is not complete. It's inadequate. And again, I mentioned this last time, science is searching for a theory of everything or a grand unified theory.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't say it's a consensus out there yet, but there's a lot of work going on that suggests that until subjective, qualitative, interpersonal factors are brought to the table, science is just going to continue to try and split an atom into molecules or electrons and protons into quantum units, quarks, muons, gluons, and so on, and continue to drive themselves insane as they continue to find something smaller. So they realize that there's something beyond matter, beyond what the five senses can measure. And this takes us back to the perennial wisdom again, which suggests very strongly that there is a non-physical world or set of dimensions that is transcendent of the five physical senses. So we're attempting to integrate these together and bring information from different kinds of perception to bear. And to come back to the channeling phenomenon, the Seth phenomenon in particular, this helps us to understand what's going on there.
Yeah, just to sort of put this on the table too, quantum physicists, I think, a number of occasions have determined that subatomic particles do not exist except as probabilities until they are observed, which in simpler terms means that nothing exists until someone looks at it, until someone knows it exists.
And just to clarify that, nothing exists in physical five senses terms until the eye transmits through the optical nerve to the optical occipital lobe in the back of the head, and the mind processes that data. Then a measurement is taken, and something from these infinite probable states collapsing the wave function, they call it, come into existence. But it does exist in this quantum foam, in this implicate order, to use David Bohm, a physicist who passed away, I think, in the late 80s, early 90s. Even though they don't exist physically, they do exist in some potential form. And that, again, there's a link there to the perennial wisdom.
Okay, so they exist as probabilities. They exist as some sort of underlying energy, but not...
Right, potentials.
Potentials, but not physical matter as we're used to thinking of it.
And it does raise the question, well, what creates those potential energy forms, even if they're non-linear, non-local, non-physical? But that's a larger philosophical issue I won't answer. I'm just bringing the question to bear.
Yeah, that's a good question, because what, you know, if physical matter is really something else until it's observed, you know, what exactly is it before it's observed?
And what is the relationship of the observer to the observed? And the big philosophical quandary of hard science is, well, what happened before the Big Bang? It's even possible to concede in terms of a creation myth, which is what the Big Bang is, from the hard science point of view, the materialist point of view, to concede that there may well have been a Big Bang. But yet the question has to be considered and is not answerable in the current scientific paradigm. What existed before the Big Bang? What existed in terms of these nonlinear, non-local potentials? And that gets into cosmology and ultimately to some sort of God concept.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to take a quick musical break here, and we'll be back in just a minute or so. And you're listening to 93.7 San Francisco Liberation Radio, and we're speaking with Paul Helfrich, PhD, and we'll be back in just a minute. You're listening to 93.7 San Francisco Liberation Radio, and this is Vico here with the Vico Show. And today we are speaking with Paul Helfrich, Director of Programs and Technology for New World Views, and we're talking about channeling, we're talking about quantum physics, states of reality, and I think we were just mentioning, you know, what was there before the Big Bang, and I think you had said, Paul, that that gets into the idea of God.
Yeah, the idea of a primary source, first cause, whatever you want to call it, that takes us back to 3,000 years in the written tradition of the perennial wisdom that states unequivocally that there is a spirit, whatever you want to call it, non-physical, non-linear, primary source that has to be considered in our conversation.
Yeah, I think that perhaps before fairly recently, probably before the past 100 years or maybe even 50, people I think were a little more open-minded to a non-scientific explanation of reality on a personal level, on a lot of different levels. Now we seem to be in this stage where science kind of has the market on truth and facts cornered, at least in the mainstream. But I think that is slowly changing. I think that, though, some of the ideas we're discussing would have been maybe a little bit easier for an audience 100 years ago to maybe swallow. Do you think that's true?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, we're talking in generalizations, and to be honest, that's all we can really do in our conversation. Even if we had 200 or 2,000 people interacting, I mean, there's 6 billion people on the planet. And, you know, it's hard to attempt to speak for all of them. Science attempts to do that. Even theology, perennial wisdom, attempts to do that. They both fall short, but still a point to be made when science becomes distorted and calcified and dogmatic. It's called scientism. It's not true science. It's more like a cult or a religion, and people hold on to ideas and notions and their paradigm. And even though there's evidence on the fringe and getting more and more noisy and more prominent, they resist changing the paradigm. And good science does that. It wants to take a theory and prove it or disprove it or modify it and improve it and refine it. All the great art science has done that, and even the cognitive sciences are involved in that too. On the other hand, when you just take a religious set of ideas, scripture and whatnot, and codify it and calcify it, it becomes Buddhism, it becomes Judaism, it becomes Sethism, to use the Seth material. It just means people are spouting, are parroting back what the scriptures or the books say, and they don't understand what's called the subtext or the deeper meaning that can't ever be captured by written language. So we have a distortive nature of all human endeavors, from science to religion, but we also then have glimmers of truth in all of those areas too.
Yes, you're saying that once any system of thought or belief gets into the mainstream, or even is followed by even any subculture, it can become an ism, and then it's abstracted to the point where, I guess, it still has value, but I guess what you're getting to is that the value, the farther away from yourself the information gets, the more it's watered down. So I guess the question is, where can we get accurate information, or at least what path can we follow to, I guess, as individuals, as a species and a planet, to try and get close to having, truth, I guess, the quest for truth. What is maybe a path that we can start to, at least a direction we can move in to get more accurate information?
I mentioned at the outset the issue of discernment, discerning what is true. That ultimately, in my view, comes back to the individual. We each determine in our own lives what is true and what is not true. So we need to cultivate within ourselves what the Buddhists call wisdom awareness, which is an ability of discerning what's true and what's not true. And it gets into an area of philosophy that's based on how do we know what's true and what constitutes the rules of evidence to determine what is true. They call that, they use a fancy word called epistemology for that. But you're really asking an epistemological question there. And the perennial view that I subscribe to, it's articulated best by an American philosopher named Ken Wilber, and I want to plug a book that he wrote several years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, called
right
Marriage of Sense and Soul. So check that out by Ken Wilber. But he talks about three basic ways of knowing anything. One is through the five senses, where we're just using quantities, which is we use mathematics to measure things. A second complementary way of knowing things is through the mind, and that uses language to discern or interpret. And that gets into that area of what we then take numbers, statistics, and personal experience, and we create beliefs then based on that about what is true and what's not true. And the third type of knowing is really from the perennial wisdom and the perennial traditions, and it's a translogical or transcendent type of perception that is essentially irrational. And there's another word you can add to your opening statement of words that create fear in us, like anarchy and channeling and so forth. They say irrational. Oh, it's not good to be irrational. And yet, in every authentic perennial tradition, there are detailed systems of exercises you can loosely call it yoga, that push the rational mind into areas of irrationality to expand it, to look at the truth. The truth with a capital T is not rational. The answer to what came before the Big Bang is not rational. But that doesn't mean we throw out the baby with the bathwater. It means we integrate these three ways of knowing, the quantitative, the qualitative, and the transcendent. And in those three, and this is basically Wilbur's thesis that I think he articulates very well, by integrating those three, and he calls it the eye of flesh, which represents the five senses, the eye of mind, which represents our internal subjective world, and the eye of contemplation, which represents the transcendent states experienced by the sages and adepts and seers of the perennial traditions. And by integrating and cultivating those three ways of knowing, this is a key element of bridging science and spirit. And I think that's a very sound approach to this. And of course, it stretches classical, conventional, materialist science at its edges. And of course, it resists that. And yet, there's a lot of wonderful thinkers out there, theorists, researchers, who are open to the idea. They're still skeptical, as a good hard scientist remains, until they're given proof, undeniable proof of something. And what typically happens with scientists who are basically what we call the materialists, which mean they trust only their five senses and what they can measure, is that they have some sort of paranormal experience. And when you research the philosophers and scientists and alchemists throughout history, it goes back to Plato and Aristotle, Descartes, Plotinus, and then you get into the perennial philosophers who were mystical to begin with. They start to have what we would in scientific terms call paranormal experiences. And suddenly the hard materialist paradigm falls apart because that cannot explain what just happened or what continues to happen. And to bring the channeling phenomena back in and the work of Jane Roberts, this just continued. Once it began for her, this phenomena kept unfolding, and she could not find adequate answers in psychology or Catholicism. When she was raised, raised in the Catholic faith, she could not find adequate answers, so she marginalized those areas and actually dove into her own experiments and theoretical writings.
So she was able to go in a direction away from hard science. Let's hold on to that thought, and we're going to take another quick musical break, hopefully just about 1 minute, and we will be back. This is 93.7 San Francisco Liberation Radio and the Vico Show, and we are talking with Paul Helfrich, PhD. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to 93.7 San Francisco Liberation Radio, your local community broadcaster right here in San Francisco. And we have Paul Helfrich on the line, Director of Technologies and Programs at, or Programs and Technologies rather, at New World View. And we were discussing perennial wisdom, channeling, and altered states of being and exploration outside of maybe traditional avenues. And we had a little technical problem there, and hopefully we will get through. We might have a little static on the line, so if you can bear with us, I think the subject is certainly worth hanging out for, even if we have not exactly a perfect technical quality. I think our quality of the discussion will more than make up for that. Paul, you had mentioned that the science fiction author Jane Roberts had to explore different areas and kind of branch out into virgin territory, as it were, because her questions could not be answered by science or her Catholic upbringing. what maybe we can get into what were those explorations?
Well, yeah, Jane, as I mentioned earlier, started to experience paranormal experience. And I should give a little background about Jane Roberts at this point. She lived from 1929 to 1984. She passed away when she was 55. She lived most of her adult life in Elmira, New York. So she's an American writer and psychic, author, poetess. And she was married to Rob Butts, who was her life partner. She never had any children. And so they ended up dedicating their lives to their creative pursuits. Her husband, Rob, was a painter and still is a painter and was very involved with the Seth phenomenon. Jane was a writer with a capital W. This is what she went to school for and pursued with all of her creative passion. And she was a published science fiction author, as you mentioned, in the late 50s and early 60s. I believe there was a Rod Serling, he of the Twilight Zone fame, anthology or set of science fiction works that published some of her work and whatnot. And she was looking about for a book project to do or whatnot. And in September of 1963, she sat down after dinner to do her evening writing. She had a transformational paranormal experience. And I think in the popular consciousness, we've heard about near-death experiences. Well, this was not a near-death experience. Her body was fine. Those are usually associated with trauma of some kind. People in surgery, people in accidents, or suffering heart attacks. She was sitting at her writing desk and was suddenly out of body. And this experience lasted several hours. So it wasn't just a peripheral, did I see that? Or what was that? Did I hear that? This was manifest for over 2 hours. So you have to use your imagination to try and imagine. Psychedelic isn't the right word either.
Wow.
You know, in her description of it, there were visual elements like that. But she, when she came back to her normal waking sense of identity, she saw that she had written 40 pages in a manuscript that was called The Physical Universe as Idea Construction. And so this transformational event led to a series of events that she started to investigate ESP, which is what it was called at that time in 1960, extrasensory perception. Rob suggested to her, well, why don't you do a book on ESP? Because she could not understand what had happened and what that manuscript meant, but it contained in it the seeds of what was to be fleshed out for the next 21 years in what's now called loosely the Seth material. And her dream life became much more vivid. Her dream recall became much more vivid after that experience in September. And so Jane was researching an ESP book and to dig into this and try and find answers to what was going on, as any good scientist would, or self-observer would. And in December of 63, they started doing some experiments with a Ouija board. And, of course, in religious belief systems, the Ouija board is considered an occult artifact or tool. But they were experimenting with that, and their first couple of sessions was just gibberish and nonsense, and nothing happened. But the third or fourth time they sat down, the planchette, it's called, where you place your hands on this board, and a Ouija board, for those of you who don't know, is an alphabet, and it has numbers, and it has some things like yes and no, and the idea is you ask questions, contact a discarnate spirit or whatnot, and it speaks through the board, which, of course, is through your kinesthetic or muscle memory. So she and Rob sat down, and Rob would have one hand on the planchette, and with the other hand was writing down the questions, was being a scribe and somewhat scientific in the questions that they asked and the answers that they got. And somewhere around the third or fourth session, they got a personality, a clear personality, who called himself Frank Withers. So they asked questions, and they weren't sure what was going on. And around the fifth or sixth time they did this, and I believe this was in a two-week period, give or take, suddenly this Frank Withers disappeared, and this personality that called itself Seth introduced itself. And that then led, in another week or two, to a situation when they sat down to do a board session. Jane started to know what the answers were. She could sense the answers. She describes it as if she was standing on the edge of a high dive, wanting to jump off, but being afraid to take that leap of faith, so to speak. But she, of course, since the impulses were so strong, finally began to speak. And so it evolved into a situation where they would start with the Ouija board because that was comfortable and they had no idea what was going on. And then Jane would speak in an altered state very slowly, and Rob would write everything down. And from that point on, in early 1964, through her death in September of 1984, she would hold sessions twice a week. And there's a lot more to this story that many people don't know about Jane Roberts and the Seth material, but Seth was only one aspect of her psychic repartee, shall we say. It's the best known in metaphysical circles. But Jane, we talked earlier about how an athlete, an artist, a psychic, their ability develops through time. And by the time Jane's abilities were full-blown in the 11th, 12th year of her doing this, I've been able to discern from researching the body of work over 11 different distinct or discrete focuses or types of altered states that she would go into. And of those 11, the Seth personality, just one, but the most famous. So this collaboration continued for her creative life, and it resulted in over 30 books during that time. And just very briefly, there are 18 published Seth books today. There are 3 introductory books that Jane authored and used excerpts from the Seth material. There are 3 what she called aspect psychology books that she authored and offered her own theoretical speculations on her own experience, and actually offered a framework that paralleled the development of the transpersonal psychology movement in the early 60s. She did 2 worldview books, and she wrote some science fiction, 3 Oversoul 7 books. She wrote 2 books of published poetry, and her poems are throughout various books. Also, she wrote a children's book. And there's also 2 books by her friend and protege, Sue Watkins, that describe Jane's ESP class that she did for 8, 7, 8, 9 years, once a week on Tuesday nights. And another book, speaking of Jane Roberts, remembering the author of the Seth material, which is a nice sort of personal anecdotal description of her interaction with Jane that doesn't put Jane and her work up on a pedestal, but is a very human and a frail human picture of what she did. But all in all, we have a virtuosic example of creative output and a large body of work that characterizes what I call conscious creation. That was the very first question that you asked me this evening, to define conscious creation. So now we're at a point that I can answer that question, saying that it's really the entire output of Jane's work dealing with the Seth phenomenon and her understanding of it and the related works, even the science fiction, even the poetry, even the worldview book.
Okay. Cut out for just a second there, but I perhaps there are many people in the world experiencing things, altered states like this. Perhaps it was the fact that she was a writer and a prolific one that we have, and also I guess had her partner helping her write as well, that we have so much material on this so that this is available for us to see, unlike maybe others who didn't write at all.
Exactly. That's a very good point. The fact that Jane was a writer with a capital W is a blessing in terms of the volumes of information. And I should also mention that her archives of all of her papers and writings have been donated by her husband, Rob Butts, to the Sterling Memorial Library at Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut. So it is the second most visited body of work there at Yale University, which is an interesting point. It shows the depths of information and the usefulness that it has that people find. The second most visited archive in the Yale collection. And this one to me.
That's second most visited. Do you know what the first is?
I forget. I know they have a copy of an original Gutenberg Bible.
So that's a good guess.
But that would be a guess.
And So in all of her writings, for those who probably haven't read any of her writings on the altered states and this phenomena, maybe you should start by outlining the body of work and what's contained there.
Sure. I mentioned that she did these sessions where she would sit down and give dictation, and her husband, by hand, would write these down and later type them up. Those became the manuscripts, but there were over 1,850 of these sessions recorded in the 21 years. And as an introduction to conscious creation and the work, there are three basic ideas that I've been able to distill the work down to, and that is useful information about our world, which deals with the nature of the universe and consciousness and so forth, the nature of ourselves in terms of what we'll loosely call the multidimensional psyche, and third, how we can all get along, a discernible set of natural laws and the ethics that come out of that. So those three areas, our world, ourselves, and how we can all get along, is really what conscious creation attempts to address.
Okay. I'm going to stop you right there, and we're going to go to a quick musical break again. And you're listening to 93.7 San Francisco Liberation Radio. And we're going to be back with Paul Helfrich, and we're going to talk about the world, ourselves, and how we can all get along. We'll be back in just a minute.